You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren. Our special episode today was recorded live at the Rocky Mountain Labor and Employment Relations Association annual conference at History, Colorado on Friday, September 23rd. We're going to hear from a panel called the New Wave of Trade Unionists, Shop Floor Organizing in the 21st Century. Our guests are Lucy Albers-Mead, a shift supervisor at the Starbucks in Greeley, and Stephanie Vigil, a delivery driver for DoorDash, candidate for State House District 16, and member of the Colorado Independent Drivers Union, CWA Quad 7.
We'll start by getting to know our guests a little better. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what got you started organizing. And we'll start with you, Lucy.
Hi, so I have been at Starbucks for about 2.5 years now. And in the beginning, I started right when the pandemic started. And so that's kind of all I've ever known is that sort of chaotic, brand new type of management from Starbucks, because they didn't know what was going on, we didn't know what was going on, and it's really only gotten worse even now. And so I think what kind of prompted us specifically at our location to unionize was the fact that nothing was getting better, even not post-pandemic, but in the throes of it here, that nothing was getting better, and we were only getting short-staffed all the time, and no one was feeling comfortable in the workplace, and everyone was feeling burnt out. And so I just decided to take the steps towards unionizing and making sure that we were all in a safe and comfortable environment.
Definitely.
Hi, everybody. It's Steffi Vigil. We're Steph, friends, and you seem like friends, so please call me Steph. So I do drive on DoorDash as well as Grubhub, Uber Eats. I've tinkered with pretty much all of them except the ride shares. And I'm actually a committed gig worker and community organizer. So in my later 20s, I developed a disability. I wasn't able to work at all for a while, moved in with family. And as I started to move into long-term recovery, the name of the game for me was to find things to do that brought in money and engage my passions that weren't necessarily a single full-time 40-hour-a-week job. Because I think, as we all know, there's just room for so many other types of work patterns in this world. We need other people to do other kinds of work than just a single 40-hour-a-week job. And so I had a cookie business for a while. I've been a live-in nanny. I've been a part-time nanny. I've just kind of done a little bit of everything. And the gig work on the apps that I've really stuck with, because I want to have an impact on how we interact with that system so that it is worker-friendly and not just benefiting the investor class that owns the application. So I teamed up with Colorado Independent Drivers United over the last year, as well as a nationwide movement with an app called Para and the Drivers' Rights Movement.
Great, and we're gonna stick with you, Stephanie. I want to ask you to kind of illuminate, you mentioned not a standard 40-hour work week. Can you maybe reveal a little bit of the human side of DoorDash and these delivery apps? Take us through the steps that you take, the challenges you face, how you are able to make a living. Just kind of reveal a little bit to us.
Yeah, this has been a comment. I've done a number of interviews about this and had various conversations with people, and I always make a little joke up front, like, ha ha, wouldn't it be funny if DoorDash deactivated me for what I'm about to say? And I feel like I have to put that out there just in case they actually do, because it would make for a really interesting story if they find out, you know, somebody talked bad about us in public. Yeah, so, you know, the thing about the gig app is that, and the, just the whole industry, technically, they don't hire me, they don't employ me. I work for myself. That's supposed to be the nature of the thing. Frequently what is happening, and more as they refine their algorithm and figure out how to make the most out of it, is that it very selectively reveals and conceals information. So when I go to accept an offer when I'm working, I multi-app for one. I always have two, if not three apps running at the same time. It alerts me that there's an offer. I very quickly do, usually it's on my dash and I'm driving, so it's like this because I'm safe. And if I see that it's not enough dollars per mile, if I know that that restaurant tends to be late, if I know that that address is too far out of town for me, I'll say no. So, you know, in the meantime, it's really a matter of thinking like you're your own business owner when you are using the app as a means of finding work for yourself, which is the independent contract model, except that when we developed that model for, like, you know, employee categorization and how we do the taxes, you were talking about things like, I'm going to fix your leaky faucet, right? Or I'm going to build a deck for you, or I'm going to design your website. It was a one job, you did it. It was clear that was the contract. Whereas on the apps, basically every offer that comes in is a contract, right? I'm taking like dozens of contracts or denying dozens of contracts a day. So the math has to be really quick. And if they're not allowing, say, like supplementary apps to interact with it, like Para, which is a really popular one that they've been shutting out, then I don't actually have control over my work, and I don't actually get to own my own data, and I don't actually get to value my own time and structure it. And so that's kind of been the battle with us, is how do we keep, if they want to keep it in that model where they don't have vehicles because it's ours, and we pay our own insurance, and we pay our own gas, and we set our own schedule, then we also have to have that autonomy, and that's where that challenge comes in.
Great, thank you so much for that answer. We're going to go to Lucy. Lucy. Okay, over 200 Starbucks have voted to unionize, slightly further in the process than your store, which, if I'm right, is still, there's ballots out and people are voting now.
Our vote is actually in a week from now.
Okay, mm-hmm. The vote starts in a week from now. So for the stores that have already unionized, they've held the vote and come back and found that it was sufficient to form that union. Only three stores have even had an initial bargaining session. Are you worried at all about Starbucks slow walking this to bargain? And what could it mean to the solidarity that you're building?
I mean, I think Starbucks does kind of play that up as like there's no contract yet. And so I think they use it sort of as a fear tactic almost to kind of push us away from unionizing, because they said, you don't know what this contract is going to look like. No one's actually gotten this yet. And so I think for us, I feel like we all want the same things. And so for me personally, I'm not worried that we're going to come to an agreement that is satisfactory for all parties, but I know that they have used that in the past to push us away from that.
I wanted to just ask a kind of general question. We're going to start with Lucy and then go to Stephanie. But how do you stay in touch with coworkers? How have you all been communicating, organizing, meeting, those sorts of mm-hmm. things?
Specifically, my store is in a college town, and so a lot of us are college-age students, and we don't have a lot of older staff or partners on our team, and so a lot of us are very adept at technology and using technology to communicate with each other, and so we tend to stay in touch with each other with social media and a lot of group chats and like, oh, let's go hang out after work, and a lot of us are friends outside of work, and so I think that keeps us in sort of this kind of community together and working on this union.
Now, Stephanie, a very different situation.
Yeah.
How do you communicate and talk with other drivers?
Yeah, well, and it's a very non-traditional type of union as well, right? We don't have a shared workspace. We're necessarily not going to have a collective bargaining contract of any kind. And sometimes I will find that there are some fellow drivers who are, they're like, yeah, I want the system to work for us, I want the change, but why would we work together when we're competitors for offers? And that's a really unfortunate angle to take, because it's only true up to a point. I think the real competitor is how much more of this transaction is the app getting as opposed to us, the drivers. That's ultimately. But so they do run into that with some of those folks when I try to organize in person, which is just, that's just tricky. Unless you're standing next to somebody in a lobby or, you know, for instance, maybe like lined up outside an airport, because Uber and Lyft drivers do that. And we've had some success with recruiting new rideshare members that way.
All right. We're actually going to stick with you a little bit on that. If you could just talk about sort of what the theory is around the Colorado Independent Drivers Union, or it is an innovative and different way of looking at unionizing, and just kind of let us know a little bit of how you've what you see that like.
Sure. A lot of it is in enforcement and improvement of the existing the existing regulatory structure. So like I indicated in, you know, an earlier remark, that independent contract model is, it's okay for this, but it's still based off of the old style of work, and we're moving into like a very different future of work, where we will see more app-based work and we will see more independent contract work. And if it is still modeled off of that, you know, 1099 idea that you're working odd jobs, that it starts to apply to us less and less. So for instance, there's the TNC Act in Colorado in 2014 established some rules for how Uber and Lyft could operate in the state. And you know, providers, you can operate here, here's your license, here are some requirements that you need to meet, like the transparency with your drivers and that sort of thing. Enforcing that is extremely difficult, right? It goes through the Public Utilities Commission. You can't really go to the Department of Labor and Employment and get missing wages returned to you if you weren't really technically entitled to them in the first place. So we've seen a little bit of luck with that, with say like a DoorDash driver getting missing wages recovered from DoorDash on the understanding that if they deactivated him and he had a lingering check, they did owe that to him. And they loosely identified him as an employee of DoorDash. And like, that's the most we've been able to get out of it. It's the regulatory structure that's not up to par. And I don't have an easy answer for that, except to say the future of work is not gonna be like granddad's trade union from 50 or 100 years ago, right? It's getting it caught up to the technology that we're actually living and working with.
We're listening to a panel discussion at the Rocky Mountain Labor and Employment Relations Association's annual conference with Lucy Albersmead, a Starbucks worker at a store that just voted to unionize, and Stephanie Vigil, a DoorDash driver, state house candidate, and member of CWA's Colorado's Independent Drivers Union.
Yeah, and I'm just going to lean into the regulatory wonkiness with this question that I carefully wrote and is a little bit educational too. So in Australia, the Transit Workers Union, some background on that, the Transit Workers Union is their main transportation union for cabs, trucks, folks that it goes from when they were using horses. So that union has developed a charter with DoorDash and Uber and others that are more traditional companies that have six core principles, which is a collective voice for workers, dispute resolution, training resources, transparency, access to, and this is appropriate rights and entitlements, and a three-stage approach towards achieving an agreement that they'll work together to get those regulations passed. Is that something that we could see in Colorado? Is that something you'd see as a viable option, creating some sort of a more defined regulatory framework?
So perhaps in Colorado, yes. And right, I can speak for our state because I live in our state, but we have, you know, a multi-state country that we're looking at. What happens on the other side of our border, right? And they, I would imagine, have less of that problem with their agreement as far as competing levels of law. So the national movement that I've joined forces with, we have four main principles, right? One is I'm in charge of my work, my time is valuable, I own my data, and I deserve a voice in the system. Those are our four major principles. And I think there is a way to work that into employment law in Colorado. I think the challenge becomes how do we get it to a point where it's actually a labor relations conversation at all? Because currently it is caught up as a utilities issue, or kind of as a transportation issue, or kind of just like a licensing issue, or DoorDash almost have no regulation at all, and they're actually spending big money to get more of what they want out of the state in the way of liquor sales, liquor delivery. Just put a pin in that for later if you are not aware. So yeah, I think it becomes a matter of extracting it from regulatory agencies that aren't up to snuff and getting it to where it actually is a labor and employment decision in the first place.
Thank you. All right, Lucy, I was going to ask if you could maybe take us back to the initial conversations that sparked the effort at your Starbucks. In your experience, how did it start?
So I think it almost started as a joke, honestly. We, for a long time, our store, we've had issues with our management just, you know, not taking our needs into consideration and just like constantly walking all over us. And so me and a couple of my other shift supervisors had kind of gotten to talking like, oh, you know, like, you know, something would go wrong and we'd be like, oh, well, we should unionize because of this, you know, whatever, like as a joke. And then the more I learned about the Starbucks Workers United group, I had actually run across them on TikTok. And so obviously social media influences at work here, and so I ran across them and was like, oh, this is a big move and this is something that I want to be a part of. And so I think after that I just started talking to people and being like, hey, like this is a thing, let me send you these videos, let me talk to you about this, let me see, like, you know, can we do this, will that make a difference in our store? And so I think we all just kind of decided, well, nothing's going to change unless we change something, and so this was the change that we needed there.
Great. And then with the use of technology in TikTok, is that something that's continued as you've built the campaign in Greeley specifically?
I don't think us so much using TikTok, but I think the momentum has continued because of the TikToks that are going out through like Starbucks Workers United and just like the videos that are out there of all of these things happening in all of these different stores across the country of, you know, long-term partners being fired because they're just a part of the union boards, or, you know, stores getting closed down because they're unionizing, and just all of these like atrocities that just keep happening across the country. And I think that that evidence helps unify all of us.
Yeah, that's a good leeway into the Memphis Seven. That's the nickname that's been given to seven Starbucks workers that were laid off or were fired in Memphis, Tennessee. Their case, that firing happened in February. They were found to be illegally fired and reinstated just a few weeks ago. Is that something that is known on the shop floor, discussed, talked about?
I think in higher up discussions of it, absolutely it is well known. I mean, I know about it. I think all of my union organizers know about it just because we're interested in the cause. But I think it's harder to get people, like just our baristas on the floor, to be more deeply involved with the unions. And so I don't know, unless they follow like the news or they've been watching videos or something like that, like they're not really going to know about these issues. And so I think it is important, you know, as organizers, to get that information out there and get them to know these issues.
Okay. And then as a shift supervisor within the system, I take that, and when I've been in roles like that, you're often taking directives from somewhere out, from up high, and trying to, you know, enact them on the lower level, or enact them in a way that is, you know, creates the success that you're expected in your position. How do you think being a shift supervisor influenced your thoughts on unionizing or the need to make change?
I think I didn't realize how bad it was until I became a shift supervisor. I've only been a shift supervisor for about a year now, and so I think I started to see more issues at a higher level when I became a shift supervisor, and I could see like all of these things weren't just issues with my store specifically, and that they were issues across the board in all of the stores in our district. And I have friends at other stores in my city, and all of them are saying the same thing. And whether or not they're thinking about unionizing, I'm not exactly sure, but they have the same issues of understaffing and overworked and just not being comfortable at their job.
Recent Bloomberg Law analysis from the National Labor Relations Board found that unions are having their best year since 2005, so winning 641 workplace elections in the first half of this year alone. The approval rating in the Gallup poll, do you approve labor unions, is at 71%. That's the highest since 1965. Why do you think that is, and what influence is it having on the organizing you're trying to do? We'll start with Stephanie for this one.
Well, I think certainly the big financial crisis in 2009, and having a lot of folks, I'm like an elder millennial, I'm 38, but I think folks, you know, around my generation and a bit younger, saw the excesses of people not, you know, of all of the wealth going to a limited number of people and not necessarily going to the folks who do most of the work, or in some cases, all of the work. And then, you know, you just add to that, like the last handful of years, especially throughout COVID, just a couple of years ago, we all agreed that folks that do work like Lucy's and mine, that we are essential. This is essential work. That group got a nice little pat on the back and some nice banners and yard signs. They said, thank you for going to work when none of the rest of us did. We stayed home if we could while you made us coffee and brought us food. Thank you very much. And then as the as COVID has begun to wane a little bit, it's been like, oh, well, what do you want now? What do you want? More pay? You want safety at work? You want a seat at the table? Like, we finally gave you a raise that you would have been able to live on 10 years ago. What more do you want? And, again, it's just like we're making up for lost time just barely and being told that that's already more than we deserve. And I think it's finally gotten under people's skin to the point that we've kind of gotten back to some basics, right? Where does the wealth and prosperity in our country come from? Well, it doesn't come from people who have the most money. It comes from our labor. It comes from our time and effort. It comes from people getting productive things done, right? A Starbucks without baristas is just a building with a bunch of coffee beans in it. That's all that is. So the people who create the value should have a seat at the table, should have a say. And I think it finally got to enough people, especially throughout COVID, that it was like, still dragging myself to work and putting on all this PPE if I'm lucky enough to have it. Six people in my shop got sick this week. It could be me next. Nobody has died from COVID more than cooks. That's the number one most deadly profession for COVID is people who feed us. So yeah, I think it finally got under everybody's skin. I'm very sorry if I took all of the. Go ahead.
No, I would fully agree with all of that. I think it was COVID that changed our values a lot. I think people realized being home and with the world just being insane, like what really matters to us. And I think that's our own health and our own safety and living. And I think that's hard when you're just in a constant state of, going to work and going to classes and just, rushing and you're not thinking about your life. And then COVID puts all of that on hold. And I think that really makes you realize that you want that time to yourself and you don't want to be overworked and you don't want, to be walked all over by your company. And so I think that absolutely COVID has changed everyone's stance on what they deserve in a workplace, and that I think that the workplace should work for you as much as you work for it.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering if you could dig into some more specifics in Starbucks, the things that I can think of going back to some of my earlier positions and challenges there. If there were things that you could get into a contract or things that you could just ameliorate right now, what would those be?
I will say I have been on a Zoom meeting recently about contract bargaining, and so I was able to review some of the things that they're thinking about putting into the contracts. And so a lot of it is workplace safety, making sure that everybody has the tools, that they're equipped with the right tools to make sure that if something goes wrong at work, that they get time off, that they get paid for hazard pay or anything like that. The dress code isn't discriminatory, that people can come in and express themselves the way that they want to, that people are getting paid what they need to be paid in order to make a living. Just things like that. Basic human rights is what we're fighting for.
That's actually a good follow-up. I had the opportunity to go sit in on the vote count at the Superior Starbucks, the first unionized Starbucks in Colorado, and I dragged my kids up there. I was like, this is historic. But here's what I was really struck by, having sat in on other union counts and other votes, is just how I know men are involved, but the leadership of this is, at least what I've seen, who I've been speaking to, has been universally young women or often gender nonconforming. So that's an aspect of this. And with my awkward phrasing and all that, I just wanted to say, what aspect does gender or new thoughts on gender play in this? And the reason I'd ask it in this point is because you had mentioned, being able to express yourself in the way that you'd like. So just wondering if you might be able to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I myself am non-binary, and so I think, as far as I've seen in all of the meetings that I've had, I've gone to a bunch of union trainings, I've been to a bunch of meetings with people who are involved in this, and it tends to be women and non-gender conforming people in charge and that are leading these movements, and I think that's what we need right now is new voices and new people and just new insight into the world of unions, and because typically unions are very male heavy and they're run by a lot of men, and I think this new wave is very different because we're focused on different things and things like, you know, individuality and, you know, being able to express yourself, which wouldn't necessarily be a consideration in the past. That's not something that people would have thought about. So I think that's very interesting.
All right. I'll pass it to you, Stephanie, if you want to talk a little bit.
I mean, I think there might be, just in general, there's a way that men tend to be socialized that is even more individualistic than a lot of our culture, and like not at all taking any shots at anyone in the room. Just, you know, this is just what I see. And that it, pretty frequently when it comes to like, well, there's a problem at work, like this isn't going well with our management, don't we all kind of have an issue with this? I feel like the way that we all tend to be socialized across genders is that men just tend to be, I think, a little bit more likely, like, well, I'm individually supposed to fix this and either get out of it or make it better for myself here or do what I gotta do. And like, you know, for women and for non-male people generally, we have generally had to figure out how we're going to make it work together because we have not had like our hands on the levers of power most of the time anyway, whether that's, you know, capital or, you know, positions of prestige. So it's just kind of, I think, like a natural, it's a natural next step for people to take as far as like, you know, feminist and gay liberation and that sort of thing, to also start looking at how do we make our workplaces also just less patriarchal. And the way that you do that is to center non-male voices and let us form that community around it. Good for you, because honestly, what I'm just sitting here thinking about it too, like, yeah, this is why it's so important that we make those kinds of changes at places like Starbucks and like Amazon and big, big, big employers, because they will end up putting pressure on the rest of the industry to kind of come around to what workers need, yeah. Right? It's a good, you're a catalyst.
Yeah. Stephanie, in addition to your work as a delivery driver, you're also running for State House. What would it mean to have the voice of a gig worker in the halls of power?
Well, I've been racking my brain trying to think if I know of an exception to this. I'm pretty sure I will be the first gig worker in the state, the Colorado State Legislature. And I think the power there is that, well, let's just think back to one of the first questions that you asked, and like I said, most people do if I give any kind of interview or discussion about gig work. So just walk me through it. Like, how does it even work? What is even happening? I don't, like, because if you haven't been on the other side of the app and either, you know, I think if you've taken an Uber or a Lyft home, you've seen that happen, but not from start to finish. And you certainly don't see what transpires for you to say, like, have a burrito dropped off outside your door. So what? How are you supposed to wrap your head around what's missing for those people and what's going well and what isn't? And, you know, why does Tony Hsu have over $4 billion of net worth, but they just reduced, they basically reduced pay on the base pay for DoorDash deliveries. They split it into two, like a short distance and a long distance, but they made the short distance one like $250 as base pay before any tip. So, like, if people don't know these things, if you haven't experienced it, you basically, the only way to get the right kind of legislation passed and to be attended to the kind of wraparound services and other considerations that people need is to bring somebody like that to the table. Well, I will already be there. And I know that we have no shortage of representation in our legislature for people who own the big technology, who are funded by that, who get their income from that. And to have somebody who's been in the driver's seat, I think it will be priceless. I have to learn a lot about the legislative process to put it to work, so I'm excited to get in there.
I want to thank you all for joining our panel. I want to thank Lyra for hosting this panel and bringing these voices forward, and really want to thank our guests for sharing so much of themselves and helping us learn what is happening on the ground. Finally, can we end with a round of applause for our guests?
This has been the Labor Exchange.